Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten. Mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnet? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto. Das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
Copper Bullets. The four-part series from Amazing Sports Stories is available now.
Zambia was considered as an underdog.
Are we going to do the impossible here?
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. And in a moment, we'll be hearing live from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, where protesters have clashed with police for the second time this week. Opponents of planned tax rises have been trying to march on Parliament. Water cannon and tear gas have been deployed. We'll also be hearing news of a promising new treatment for people recovering from heart bypass surgery. And President Putin of Russia has been courting his ally Vietnam. More on that coming up in the second half of the programme. But we are going to begin today talking about heat, the sort of extreme heat that people in many countries are experiencing right now. In a few minutes' time, we're going to hear from a doctor in the Indian capital, Delhi, who runs a special clinic for people suffering from heat stroke. The city and other parts of the country have been enduring record high temperatures for several weeks. There have also been heat waves in parts of Southeast Asia, in Greece and Turkey. And the weather is even hotter than usual in Saudi Arabia at the moment, where 1.8 million people are taking part in the annual Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca, the Hajj. Among them, Atta Hussein, an imam from Britain. He spoke to NewsHour yesterday and told us what conditions were like.
As you were walking, you could not walk 20 yards except you would see someone struggling in the heat. People were doing whatever they could to shade themselves. They were taking water from kind individuals who were giving it out. They were taking shades in hotel receptions. It was harrowing at times. I've never seen so many people struggle collectively. I think the Saudi authority perhaps do need to start thinking about controlling the numbers of how many pilgrims come each and every year. And this has been discussed in the past. It is a very sensitive issue, but with climate change, perhaps, with the fact that the Hajj is taking place in the summer months, they may need to look into this in more detail.
There are no official figures, but it's thought that hundreds, possibly more than 1,000 people have died on the Hajj this year because of temperatures exceeding 50 degrees Celsius. That's more than 120 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, this Nigerian pilgrim, Aisha, spoke of the unbearable heat during the ceremonies around the Kaaba in Mecca.
It's only the mercy of God that I survived it because it was extremely hot and they closed all the doors to the Kaaba. We have to use the rooftop, which is very hot. We have to use umbrella. Every cycle I've gone through, I have to use Zamzam water on my body and I have to pour water on my body and be drinking water all the time.
Well, several Midwestern states in the US are also in the grip of stifling heat at the moment. It follows a heat wave in late May and early June across the southwestern US and into Central America. Well, now in New Mexico, the problem is wildfires, which have already destroyed about 1,400 homes. This week, the entire population of Ruidoso, more than 7,000 people, was ordered to evacuate. Among them, 83-year-old Frank Lawyer, who said the experience was terrifying.
We had been watching a fire develop, and we saw it spread. And then the fear came in when the wind changed, and we could see the smoke change, and we were engulfed in smoke. That scared me to death, because then I knew we have been through several fires in the 19 years we've been there. And none of them was fierce like this one.
Well, today a group of scientists from an organization called the World Weather Attribution Group have said that recent heat waves in North America and Europe were made 35 times more likely because of global warming. Let's talk to the BBC's environment correspondent, Matt McGrath, who joins me on the line. And Matt, we have to be careful about what we're talking about here and the methodology. So which heat waves are they referring to, and how did they come up with this figure of 35 times more likely?
That's right, James. This is the heat wave that hit the U.S. Southwest, Mexico, Guatemala, Belize, El Salvador in May and June, where temperatures were soared during the day and during the night. The researchers on this team, who have done about 70 of these studies, it's a well-tried and trusted method at this point, are able to analyze the data from such a specific event over a specific period of time. They're then able to compare it to what happened in the past, and they then use climate models to be able to work out what would have happened or what the likelihood of something like this happening in a world without climate change compared to a world with climate change. And using that type of methodology, which is peer-reviewed and has been essentially approved by other scientists, they're able to work out that that this particular heat wave in May and June was 35 times more likely than would have happened before the Industrial Revolution, essentially. In fact, it was four times more likely than if it had happened in the year 2000. That shows you that there's been an increase in temperature since then and an increase in emissions and warming gases over that period.
Is there something happening this year that is making the heat particularly extreme? And I'm thinking, of course, about the El Nino effect in the first half of the year. I mean, is that a sort of one-off factor at the moment?
Yeah, the El Nino effect is obviously something that has impacted, and essentially it's now in decline, and we're likely to move into the cooler phase of El Nino, or the La Nina part of that, in the next couple of months. And yes, everybody does focus on this question, how much it does give a boost, undoubtedly, to heating. But the reality is that for the past 13 months, each month has been broken the heat record for that particular month. So we've gone through a period of quite extreme heating, and I guess many scientists and others are hoping that we may get some cooling from the La Nina event later this year. When that happens, with the La Nina and the El Nino, we'll be able to get an even clearer picture of just how much of an impact humans are having on this and on the climate. And at the moment, you would say it's quite significant.
Indeed, and we have had a separate report about the record use of fossil fuels and the emissions from them last year. What more detail do you have on that?
Well, you know, there's a lot of focus among scientists and amongst economists, I think, particularly on, is the world approaching a peak in its use of fossil fuels? Because we have global agreements from Paris. We had countries meeting in the United Arab Emirates last year promising to phase down or move away from fossil fuels. And so scientists and economists are looking for that signal. And while the numbers are still on the up, there are lots of straws in the wind that suggest we may be approaching a peak, which I think would have global significance. We've seen China's coal usage in May and April and March decline down by 4% or so over the previous year. That might by itself is not enough to indicate that the world has reached a peak, but I think taken together with some other indicators, it shows that we are perhaps moving in a more positive direction than many people would believe. And so that, combined with the massive build out of solar and wind, is giving people some belief that we could peak emissions either late last year or actually this year.
Matt, thank you very much indeed. The BBC's environment correspondent, Matt McGrath there. Well, let's head now to the Indian capital, Delhi, as I mentioned. Last month, temperatures there soared above 50 Celsius. Those temperatures in the day have since come down a few degrees. But on Tuesday, the city recorded its highest nighttime temperature for more than 50 years, a gruesome 35.2 degrees. The authorities say there have been at least 40,000 recorded cases of heatstroke during this period of scorching temperatures. One of those treating the victims is Dr. Ajay Chauhan, head of the heatstroke clinic at the Ram Manohar Lohia Hospital.
See, it has been very busy. This is kind of an unprecedented situation for me. I've been working in this hospital for past 14 years. Never have we seen so many cases arriving in our heat stroke clinic, for that matter, an entire hospital.
And what sort of people have been coming into your clinic?
See, there are two kind of heat stroke variants reported, the classical and exertional. Classical occurs in extremes of ages because of comorbidities, and exertional occurs in relatively fit people who are engaged in manual labor. The most of the cases which we have got, those of exertional variant of heat stroke, mostly males in the age bracket between 40 to 55 years. And then we have street hawkers, some destitutes also brought in by police, homeless people. But in between, we have about 3-4 females.
So the biggest group, Doctor, just to be clear, is people who effectively cannot escape the heat, either because of their work or because they're homeless and living on the streets.
Yeah, absolutely. It tends to affect the poorest more. They cannot run away from their work also, because what will they do if they don't work? There are health conditions which predispose a person to a heat stroke-like situation. These are hypertension, and not only the condition themselves, but the medicine also which a person is taking for them. Diabetics are also exposed to heat stroke. CKD patients, chronic kidney disease, I mean to say.
And can you just explain to us what happens when the body suffers heat stroke? What happens to a person's body in those sorts of conditions?
See, first and foremost is to differentiate between heat stroke and fever, because fever is when body is trying to escalate the temperature as a protective mechanism against an infection. Whereas in heat stroke, body is trying to decrease temperature. Despite all measures, body is unable to cope up, as a result of which temperature, the core body temperature taken through rectum or esophagus, begins to rise. So it is very important for us to differentiate between the two. And when the systems are overwhelmed because of environmental condition as they are, or if you continue to work on, the intrinsic body heat production increases, heat loss mechanism tend to fail or are overwhelmed. So as a result, we have a catastrophic situation with a high fatality rate. You have shivering, and then you can fall into coma. You can throw seizures, and then we have cardiac muscle damage also.
When people are in that very serious condition, how do you treat it quickly in your clinic?
See, it is the basic hallmark of treatment of heat stroke is rapid cooling and early cooling. Early cooling prevents, death. If you delay cooling, the mortality rate is as high as 7 to 30%, as reported in literature. Whereas early cooling mechanism drops it down to about 10%. So we have about 7 to 8-fold decrease in mortality. We are saying that if you see a person suffering from heat stroke, classical, just pour water below the neck area and fan him and bring him ASAP to the hospital nearest health center.
Do you think that the number of cases that doctors like you are seeing and hospitals in Delhi are seeing, is that focusing minds in government that things need to be done to try and mitigate future heat waves for people in the city?
Not a single case had come when we opened our heat stroke clinic on 8th of May. So government was alert. It was encouraging us to open heat stroke clinics last year also, but this year only we could open it. So government is alert to the fact we have a full-fledged department which is called as NPCCHH, National Program for Climate Change and Human Health. So we are but a country of such size and so much population with migrant labor. So it is difficult for us, but nonetheless, government is taking all the measures it can.
Even if that means telling workers that they mustn't go to work when it's so hot.
Not exactly. We can afford to strike a balance. So after 30 minutes or 45 minutes of work, depending on the temperature, we ask people to take breaks.
That was Dr. Ajay Chauhan, head of that heat stroke clinic at the Ram Manohar Lohia Hospital in Delhi. There is, of course, much more coverage of the extreme heat around the world on our website, and also analysis of the causes behind it, some of the context, that valuable context to that, on our website, bbc.com/news. You're listening to NewsHour. Coming up later on the programme, the Australian journalist Chung Lei, who was detained in China for more than 3 years, on life now outside prison.
I'm stronger and better than ever before. I have lots of reasons to live better, not bitterly. And I try to do justice to freedom in everything. The worst day in freedom is better than the best day in detention.
But still not avoiding contact with Chinese officials, as we'll hear in about half an hour. A recap of our main headlines from the BBC newsroom this hour. Research suggests global warming has made recent extreme temperatures in the Northern Hemisphere 35 times more likely. And Vladimir Putin is in Vietnam for a state visit aimed at underlining Russia's regional influence despite the war in Ukraine. We'll have more on that in 15 minutes. This is James Menendez with NewsHour live from the BBC. Well, let's head to Kenya now, where there have been clashes between the police and demonstrators in the capital, Nairobi, over the government's plans to raise taxes for the second time this week. Let's talk to the BBC's Anne Soy, who's outside Parliament. And Anne, just begin by telling us what's been happening today.
Well, there have been running battles between protesters and the police, anti-riot police, who have come out in large numbers today to try and prevent the protesters getting to Parliament. But they have remained defiant, many of them young people, Gen Zs, who have been mobilising themselves on social media to protest against the finance bill, which is currently being debated in Parliament. So the police have lobbed tear gas at them. They have used water cannons, but that has not quelled the protests. And it is not just happening in Nairobi. These protests have spread across the country. They're happening in other cities and towns, including the president's own hometown of Eldoret in Western Kenya.
What are the arguments against the government's plans from the demonstrators then?
Well, they say the government is making life more difficult for Kenyans by introducing new taxes, raising some of the taxes that were already existing. And, you know, they have singled out quite a number of them, including taxes imposed on imported diapers or nappies and sanitary towels. And they say such basic commodities should not be taxed. The government argues that they want to also protect the local industry, and so the tax is specifically aimed at imported goods. But the young people are hearing and not having defiant about that, and they want the bill to be rejected. The government of William Ruto says that the debt burden is huge. A lot of the government revenue, more than 60%, goes to servicing loans, and therefore they need to find new ways to raise more revenue. And that is why they have been introducing more and more taxes. But the Gen Zs, the young people out on the streets, are saying it is enough. They can't take it anymore.
Yes, tell us a bit more about the demonstrators. I mean, you mentioned that they're young people, and I've been reading that they've been organising to some extent, I mean, in the sense that there's no sort of one leader, but organising themselves on social media. Is this something new for Kenya?
It is very new. The protests we have seen before in this country have been organised by politicians, political parties. They have been organised around personalities. But this is different because you can't really single out one leader of these protests. They have several leaders, you know, who are very vocal. But it has been, you know, bubbling on social media, and then it just came out on the streets on Tuesday. So initially, people did not even think they were going to be large and, you know, they were going to be sustained. But it has, you know, spread. Today we are seeing more protests across the country.
And thank you very much indeed. The BBC's Africa correspondent, Anne Soy, joining us live from Nairobi. Now, in 2 weeks' time, voters in England, Wales, Northern Ireland and Scotland will go to the polls in Britain's general election. And in Scotland, all eyes are on whether the main opposition Labour Party can break the recent dominance of Scottish politics by the pro-independence Scottish National Party, or SNP. At the last election in 2019, the SNP won 48 of Scotland's then 59 seats in the UK Parliament. Labour just won. But the opinion polls suggest a much tighter contest this time. From Scotland, here's our political correspondent, Rob Watson.
Hello there, sir. Hi. My name is Gordon McKee. I'm the Labour candidate for the general.
You don't need to worry, I will be voting for you.
I'm here in Glasgow, a city once considered Labour through and through, but in recent decades dominated by the pro-independence SNP. We're in the south of the city, where with the Labour candidate, Gordon McKee, who's knocking on doors, known as canvassing, trying to drum up support.
I think this is the best opportunity we've had in a long time. I have been involved in the Labour Party for 10 years, and it's been a difficult 10 years, so I'm taking nothing for granted. But it's certainly true that a lot of people in Glasgow and across Scotland that have been SNP before are now turning to Labour because they see that it's the best way to beat the Conservatives and hopefully to elect a Labour government across the UK.
Thanks. Excellent. Better get on with your door knocking. All this matters because if Labour can grab a bigger share of Scotland's 57 seats, it makes it that much easier for the party to get a majority nationally and for Keir Starmer to become Prime Minister. So how's it looking? A question for Emily Gray, Managing Director of the polling company Ipsos Scotland.
On the evidence of polls in recent weeks, it looks like a very close contest in terms of vote share between Labour and the SNP. But what looks clear is that the SNP are set to suffer losses come election night. I think where the question mark still is just how heavy will those losses be?
But interestingly, of course, despite any problems that the SNP are facing, support for independence remains high, doesn't it? And has done ever since the referendum was lost in 2014.
I mean, the question of independence or staying in the union remains one that the Scottish public are divided right down the middle on. But what looks likely is that independence will be less of a feature in voters making up their minds at this election than it was last time around.
Good morning. Good morning, friends, and welcome to the launch of the SNP manifesto for the 2020.
Of course, the SNP are campaigning hard and continuing to make the case that independence remains Scotland's best option.
The very heart of our beliefs is the principle that decisions about Scotland should be made by the people who live in Scotland.
So why, given high levels of support for independence, is support for the SNP apparently falling? I'm in the centre of Glasgow to ask people.
They've got a bit complacent. The people at the top aren't as good as what they were in the past as well, so, yeah.
But there's still lots of support for independence.
Yeah, including me.
There's things that are crumbling. They've been in power for quite a while. I mean, I'm not saying that I wouldn't vote them, but I'm definitely considering my vote a lot more carefully this year.
In recent years, I'm swinging towards the Nationalists, but they're not doing any good, really.
So you think you're going to swing back to Labour?
Yeah.
But does that mean that you don't think independence is a good idea anymore?
No, I think it's a great idea, but it's not going to happen. Simple as that.
Until now, at least, a dislike of the Conservatives and of Brexit, which the majority of Scots opposed, have been strong drivers of support for independence and the SNP. But how might a change of government in Westminster and fatigue with the SNP affect the political dynamic in Scotland after the election? Alex Massey is one of Scotland's most respected political commentators.
Independence has dominated Scottish politics for more than a dozen years now, and there is a certain amount of fatigue, I think, about this constitutional wrangling. The Labour Party is expected to make significant gains at the expense of the SNP, but it would be a mistake to assume that this puts the independence question to bed forever. What we're entering is a new phase where, after a decade of constitutional warfare in Scotland, we now have a kind of frozen conflict where neither side, neither the independence supporters nor those who want Scotland to remain part of the United Kingdom, are strong enough to defeat the other.
Constitutional change does seem unlikely in the next few years, as any incoming Labour government, like the current Conservative government, would strongly oppose a new referendum on Scottish independence. But long term, the population will almost certainly remain split on whether Scotland would be better off inside or outside the Union.
And that was our UK political correspondent Rob Watson reporting that from Scotland. And next week, Rob will be looking at why, according to surveys, there's a record low level of trust in politics in the UK. You may have your own opinions on that. And I should say that a full list of all the candidates in the election can be found on the BBC website. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Do stay with us. We've got lots more coming up in the second half of the programme. Don't go away.
Seventeen members of Zambia's national football squad have been killed in an air crash. The players were on their way to Senegal for a World Cup game.
When disaster struck Zambia's national football team in 1993, many thought that was the end of the country's international football dreams.
These guys had a desire to take us to the World Cup.
The whole country was mourning.
Instead, it was the beginning of one of sport's greatest comeback stories.
We have to go on. We can't give up. We don't give up in Zambia.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service presents the four-part series, Copper Bullets. Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to NewsHour. Now, on the front page of this morning's papers in the UK is news of the damage done to Stonehenge by anti-oil protesters yesterday. They sprayed the ancient carvings with orange powder. They say it's cornflour, which will wash off in the rain. But it's not quite as simple as that. It is the summer solstice tonight, the longest day, and Stonehenge assumes centre stage for many in that. Nick Merriman is Chief Executive of English National Heritage, and he's been talking to the BBC's Amal Rajan. What did he make of the press images today?
We found them deeply saddening. It's a vandalism to one of the world's most celebrated ancient monuments, about 5,000 years old. And what we find difficult to understand is that the stones are a testament to the desire of people to connect with nature and the earth and the sun and the moon, as well as each other. So it's difficult to understand, and we're deeply saddened about this vandalism. But we've been really touched by the messages of sympathy and support we've had. Our experts have already managed to clean the orange powder from the stones because we were really worried about what would happen if they got in contact with water. And actually, at Stonehenge, not only are the stones important, but there's some really rare lichens on the surface of the stones as well, which we're trying to protect. But so far, there seems to be no visible damage. The site is open to the public again and for the solstice tomorrow.
You must have this challenge with so much of our heritage, Dr. Merriman, where you know that it belongs to the people. So you want it to be as open and accessible as possible, but that creates this enormous security risk.
We want people to be really welcome to our sites. So we have to balance the risk of access versus the possibility of acts like these. We are a charity, and therefore it's our members and our visitors who have to bear the cost of cleaning up and the relatively light and accessible approach to security that we take. So we'd rather be spending our time making the sites more accessible right across the country.
Of course. And you say this fragile lichen. Just explain what that is for our listeners and explain why you're reassured that there's not going to be lasting damage to the monuments.
Lichens are very fragile and sensitive indications of climate change, actually. And the lichens, I'm afraid I don't have the Latin names for you, but the lichens on Stonehenge are actually quite rare in southern England. Luckily, our staff moved very quickly and actually used blown air to dry, to remove the powdered substance from the lichens. So it looks like they are okay. And we were very lucky, given the atrocious weather we've had recently, that it wasn't done in pouring rain, where we fear that there would have been quite some considerable damage to the lichens.
Indeed. And do you think that you might need, I mean, given this is, as you say, a concern for much of our heritage, do you think we might need a change in the law to protect our heritage from these kind of protests or what some listeners would call vandalism?
No, we just remain saddened. We wish people would channel their protests away from cultural heritage sites, museums and galleries. That causes huge upset and disruption to the operation of these important sites.
Nick Merriman, Chief Executive of English National Heritage. This is the BBC World Service in London. You're listening to NewsHour. I'm James Menendez. President Putin may be increasingly isolated in many parts of the world because of his invasion of Ukraine, but there are, it seems, at least two countries in East and Southeast Asia willing to roll out the red carpet for him. Well, earlier this week it was North Korea, itself a pariah state. Today it was Vietnam, a country with a long-standing alliance with Russia, and before that the Soviet Union, but one that's also been trying to strengthen ties to the United States, while at the same time managing the relationship with its powerful neighbour China. Well, today President Putin and his Vietnamese counterpart Tô Lâm pledged to increase cooperation, particularly when it comes to defence and security. I've been talking to Nguyen Khac Giang, who's with the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies, a think tank in Singapore, although he's currently in Australia. Why is Russia so important to Vietnam?
Russia is considered as a legitimate successor of the Soviet Union, which was the former ally of Vietnam during the Cold War. So that sparks a lot of sentiments among not only the Vietnamese population, but also among the top leader of Vietnam as well. So that's a sentimental factor. And secondly, and more importantly, in my opinion, Russia plays a very crucial role in helping its security considerations in the region, because Russia provides most of Vietnam's weapon system, accounting for 70 to 80%. And secondly, with gas projects in the South China Sea, Russia is a main player for Vietnam to support its projects to counter Chinese aggression.
Is there a contradiction there, given the ties also between Russia and China?
Yeah, so I think that's the third factor that Vietnam really wants to host Putin now, because they obviously see that after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Russia is moving closer to China. And that sparks a lot of concern among the Vietnamese leadership, because they worry that Russia might compromise Vietnamese interests by trading its interest on the South China Sea projects for, you know, Chinese favor. So I think that's one of the main talking points when Putin met with many senior leaders in Hanoi during his trip.
I mean, what's your opinion? Do you think Russia is a reliable ally for Vietnam, or may it consider that its ties to China are actually more important when push comes to shove?
Well, I think historically, Russia really never really like let Vietnam down since the Cold War. So for Vietnam, it's trying to diversify its partnership with other countries other than Russia, and increasingly with the West, including the United States and European Union countries. But that takes time. And, you know, at the moment, it needs to at least, you know, have a reassurance from Russia that it would not move to China too quickly, so that Vietnam cannot seek for alternative security options.
It's a very difficult balancing act, isn't it? Balancing its interests with Russia, also where it wants to stand in terms of China and standing up to China in the South China Sea. And also, as you mentioned, those commercial ties to the US and Europe. Is that why they talk about bamboo diplomacy, that it's sort of swaying in the wind but not swaying in one particular direction?
Yeah, definitely. That's on the point, because for Vietnam, it used to be a country which was drawn into great power rivalry in the Cold War passively. So I think now this time they want to be an active neutral state by hedging it against three main powers of the world: Russia, China, and United States. And each of those powers actually can provide Vietnam some benefits, but not all. For example, for China, can provide Vietnam with, you know, ideological support, because they are both communists, can provide Vietnam with trade benefits. But at the same time, they are a threat in Vietnam's maritime security. And for the United States, they can provide a lot of support for trade and economic cooperation, and as a counterbalance to China's influence. But as a communist state, Vietnam is worried about United States' emphasis on democracy. And for Russia, they can help Vietnam in security guarantee by providing weapons and also by counterbalancing against China. But Russia doesn't really have a lot of, you know, capability, and is so far away from the Indo-Pacific region, so they might not be so interested in helping Vietnam in that, you know, in such context. So for Vietnam, it's important to counterbalance, you know, all of those three main powers to maximize their, you know, interests while minimizing the threats of being disaligned, you know, with each of those powers.
That was Dr. Nguyen Cac Zang. Let's head to the Middle East now, because for the last 8 months we've been talking about the risk of the war in Gaza spreading across the region, particularly across Israel's northern border with Lebanon, home to the armed group Hezbollah, which, like Hamas, is supported by Iran and even better equipped. Israel and Hezbollah have been exchanging fire since October, and tens of thousands of people on both sides of the border have had to flee their homes. So far, it's been relatively low level, the assumption being that neither side wants a full-blown war. But the rhetoric is now growing in intensity. On Wednesday, the leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, gave a televised speech in which he said no place in Israel would be spared in the event of war, and warned Cyprus not to allow Israeli warplanes to use its bases to attack Lebanon. Well, Dr. Amal Saad is an expert on Hezbollah at Cardiff University in Wales.
Obviously, this speech is a form of psychological warfare against Israel on the one hand. It is designed to deter Israel from launching an all-out war on Lebanon, but at the same time, it indicates that Hezbollah is very ready in the event of such a war.
Does it want a war with Israel at this point, do you think?
No, I think it's been very clear that Hezbollah has done its best from October 8 until today to ensure that all of its responses to Israel's assassinations and other attacks against Hezbollah fighters and even against Lebanese civilians have always sort of been sub-threshold. They've never sort of gone beyond that threshold that would lead to an all-out war.
What about the warning to Cyprus? Is that new?
Yes, that's definitely new. That is, in fact, unprecedented. This is the first time that Hezbollah actually threatens any party beyond Israel and the US. The reason for that is that Cyprus has been conducting joint military drills with Israel for some time now. The last two were in 2022 and 2023. So I think we should take this threat, you know, at face value. I think he means what he says, that if Israel does use airports and so on in Cyprus, that Hezbollah will target them.
And does Hezbollah have the capability to hit Cyprus?
Oh, definitely. I mean, Cyprus is a few hundred kilometers away. There are parts of Cyprus that are closer than other parts of Israel.
The mediator for the Biden administration has said that, you know, his negotiations have reached a dead end, negotiations between Israel and Hezbollah. So what happens next, do you think? I mean, are these sort of tit-for-tat exchanges of fire, as you put it, sub-threshold? Do you think those will continue while the war in Gaza continues? Is that going to be the pattern?
Well, it's very difficult to predict how Israel will respond. Clearly, you know, the US has been unable to pressure Hezbollah to end its attacks. And Hezbollah has been very consistent in saying that there has to be a ceasefire in Gaza for its attacks to end. So we have a stalemate now, and it's very likely that this is going to continue. Now, whether Israel will go beyond that now and say in a few weeks, as Hochstein threatened, that they will in fact attack Lebanon if there's no diplomatic solution to ending the cross-border attacks, then it remains to be seen how serious, you know, Israel is about launching an attack. So far, it does seem to be a lot of bluster, a lot of bombast, but we don't know. They might actually do that.
From both perspectives, I suppose, it's kind of an unsustainable situation where you have these continuous exchanges of fire, but also you have all these thousands of people who've had to leave their homes, and that whole border area has almost become a conflict zone.
Yes, well, Hezbollah actually, for the first time, I think, in Israel's history, has sort of created a buffer zone inside Israel rather than inside Lebanon. And there are tens of thousands of Israelis who've had to evacuate. And it's very hard for Israel to sustain this, I think. And that's why they've been threatening. There could be a miscalculation on Israel's part, even if it isn't planning an all-out war. If there is more of an escalation, if it does intensify its attacks on Lebanon, then that could be, you know, a sort of a critical juncture, yes.
Dr. Amal Saad from Cardiff University in Wales. New research has suggested that gentle shockwaves could regenerate the heart tissue of patients who've had heart bypass surgery. The device used has been dubbed a space hairdryer. Let's talk to Johannes Hohlfeld, who's Professor of Cardiac Surgery at Innsbruck Medical University in Austria, which carried out this research. Very good to have you with us on the programme. Let's just deal with this space hairdryer. I mean, I think it's more just that it looks a bit like a hairdryer, the device. Is that right?
Hello from Austria. Thank you for having me. I'm also laughing about this term space hairdryer. Actually, I don't know how a space hairdryer looks like, but obviously one of your journalists had the idea that our cardiac applicator looks like this space hairdryer. We're moving this applicator directly around the heart during a open heart operation. And obviously this is also something that looks spacey.
Yeah, quite high tech. So what exactly does it do with these shockwaves? What do those shockwaves do to the heart tissue?
Yes, shockwaves are very specific type of sound waves that shed off microvesicles, so small bubbles from the cell surface of the infarcted heart muscle. And these small bubbles then activate neighboring cells to initiate a self-healing program via the innate immune system. And what happens is that into the chronically undersupplied heart muscles, new blood vessels grow in, thereby strengthen the heart muscle, and it can then better contribute to the contraction, to the pump function of the heart, and throw out more blood.
It was just quite a small sample of patients at this stage, just 63, I think. Was it enough, though, the results to convince you that it does work?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, for a new medical device, this isn't that small as it may sound. And actually, we also had in our study protocol a interim analysis planned, which was meant to either stop the study if we would have negative effects to our patients, or halt further recruitment of patients if the effects were strong enough and the effects to the heart were better than we expected.
And what did that mean for the patients themselves? I mean, what does it mean in terms for their lives after the bypass, the sort of lives they're able to lead?
Mm-hmm. So the heart function improves significantly, meaning that the patient has a better physical capacity and a better quality of life. So patients are able to walk longer without resting. So that means they can care for their everyday lives by going to the supermarket, going for a walk with their dog. You have to imagine that those are patients who are have shortness of breath, very severely sick patients, and their physical condition in general is improved, and thereby also their quality of life.
And just very briefly, in a couple of sentences, what now? More tests before it's rolled out more widely?
So from a regulatory pathway, there are no more tests needed. So the device will be available soon. But from an academic point of view, we of course want to conduct further studies. We want to conduct larger multi-center trials to get more insight and more data on those patients.
Professor, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Professor Johannes Hohlfeld of Innsbruck Medical University in Austria. You're listening to the BBC. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. Relations between Australia and China have been pretty frosty for the past few years. Trade disputes, allegations of Chinese spying and influence peddling, and Australia calling for an international inquiry into the origins of COVID-19. However, the frost began to thaw a little this week with a visit to Canberra by the Chinese Premier Li Qiang, the first such visit for 7 years. But it was overshadowed by an incident at a news conference between Mr. Li and the Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, when officials from the Chinese embassy tried to stand in front of a well-known Australian journalist, Cheng Lei, who was sat with the assembled throng of reporters. Cheng Lei became something of a cause célèbre when she was detained in China back in 2020 and only released in October of last year. She'd been working as a business reporter for Chinese state-run English-language TV station CGTN and was accused of, quote, illegally supplying state secrets overseas. While speaking to me from her home in Melbourne, Cheng Lei first took me back to that tense moment earlier this week.
I was attending the joint signing of agreements, and while sitting in the second row, because I'm guessing the Chinese state TV camera angle would have caught me behind the ministers, the Chinese ministers, and also perhaps for fear of international news outlets panning the camera from the two leaders to me, two Chinese embassy officials tried to stand between myself and the cameras. When another journalist swapped seats with me, then the other official tried to stand on my other side.
Do you think it was partly an attempt to intimidate you in some way?
Partly, and at least to show me that someone was there to stop me if I tried something funny. Not that I would have.
Because you were just there as a reporter.
That's right. And it was very exciting for me because this is the biggest Sino-Australian story of the year. And I am reporting it in a place of freedom.
Did Australian officials get involved to try and help you or at least try and move the Chinese officials along?
Yes. In fact, you can see very clearly in the videos, there's even a bit of pushing by the Chinese embassy media officer. And despite repeated requests, there was no movement. It was very distracting, and it did remind me of being in RSDL, which is residential surveillance at a designated location, where for 6 months I had two guards to stand next to me and sit next to me at all times.
What do you think the Chinese authorities now are worried about? I mean, you talked about that they possibly worried that you might say something or there might be an outburst, but is it more than that? Is it something about what you might symbolize to them?
I think it's probably multiple reasons, but as someone who used to work inside the system, albeit the English arm, I know that for each of these state visits, there's a set script. The motorcade, the military band, the effusive welcome, and all the pomp and ceremony. And they did not want anything else. Then there is the fact that I do symbolize bad times that they wish would go away.
For the benefit of our listeners, why were you detained and held in the conditions that you just described? I mean, the sort of official line was that it was endangering Chinese national security, spying effectively. But was there an incident that triggered your arrest, you think?
It did happen around the time of deterioration in bilateral relations. Australia had asked unilaterally for China to be investigated as the source of COVID. China retaliated by putting out travel advisory warnings. Then the surveillance on me started right around that time. Nobody from China is going to deny or confirm one way or another. We can only draw our own conclusions. But hostage diplomacy is not something that China shies away from.
Yeah, from all that you say, I mean, they were looking for a reason to use you as a political pawn. Is that fair?
I'd say so.
And why do you think you were released?
The government changed. And also we had a lot of public sympathy for me, advocacy. It just became something that they could easily do and perhaps gain political goodwill.
And how's it been returning to, well, some sort of normal life, although I guess events this week reminded you that things will never be quite normal?
I'm stronger and better than ever before. I have lots of reasons to live better, not bitterly. And I try to do justice to freedom in everything. Being with my family is the best. I've been hitting the ground sprinting to rebuild this shattered life, but always with the line in mind, which is the worst day in freedom is better than the best day in detention.
Given all that you've said and all that you've been through, how should a country like Australia and indeed the West more generally deal with China?
Australia has this very difficult balancing between security and prosperity and, of course, our values. As a middle power, it's very difficult, as we saw. How do we deal with this stronger and more belligerent China when it does things like this? Despite what happened, it makes me more confident about a system of freedom, because we do debate uncomfortable and inconvenient incidents. And in China, you know that there's no mention of me at all in the Chinese internet sphere, right? A friend of mine tried to send me a link on WeChat about me, but because my WeChat had been registered in China, I can't see it. But because his WeChat was registered in Australia, he can see it. That's something I worry about, that this younger generation, if they don't use VPN or go abroad to study and live, then they just think that it's only the Western countries bullying China and all that propaganda.
That was Chung Lei speaking to me from Melbourne. And that brings us to the end of this edition of NewsHour. For me and the rest of the team, thanks so much for being with us over the past hour. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Until then, bye-bye.
Sie führen täglich hitzige Fußballdebatten? Dann probieren Sie jetzt die Big Mac-Methode. Denn nur beim Big Mac sind sich alle einig. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Die Big Mac-Methode funktioniert auch mit dem Double Big Mac und Big Mac Bacon TS. Schlichte Diskussionen über Handspiel, Abseits, Videobeweis, Aufstellung, Taktik und Auswechslungen. Bei Ineffektivität wird keine Haftung übernommen. In allen teilnehmenden Restaurants. Nur solange der Vorrat reicht.
Schatzi, bist du noch in der Badewanne?
Nein, ich bin gerade in Ägypten, schwimme im Roten Meer und tauche zu einem schönen Korallenriff.
Na dann träum weiter.
Nicht träumen, Altours buchen.
Ab Erde.
Alles drin, alles gut, alles für dich. Altours, alles aber günstig.